Good everyone, and welcome to episode number 49 of the Tim Topham TV Piano Teaching Podcast. I can't believe we're almost at 50, and stay tuned next week. I'm going to be giving everyone who is listening to this episode a very special offer as a celebration of reaching this milestone of 50 episodes, so do stay tuned for that. Today, I finally interview a guest that I've really wanted to have on the show for quite some time now. He is Neil Moore. And he's the founder of Simply Music. And this is a method or an approach, I guess, to teaching. We'll actually talk about that very chain difference in language. An approach that is quite well known around the world, and a lot of teachers use it. It's used in a number of different countries. And I also like the fact that Neil is a fellow Aussie who now lives in California. He started this method. We're going to hear all about how it actually works, the approach he's taken. And as it's part of Music Learning Theory Month on the blog, you're going to find a lot of connections between the Simply Music method and the concepts and the use of patterns, which are part of the MLT theory. So I know you're going to get a lot out of this episode. It's fantastic fun to explore this with Neil directly. And I know you're going to enjoy it and get lots out of it. So to find the show notes for this episode, head to timtopham.com/episode49. And as usual, if you're able to leave a review, just head to timtopham.com/iTunes. And as I mentioned last time, I am encouraging people, a lot of people in the podcast feedback that I got, I had about 120 responses, which was fantastic. Thank you very much if you were one of the people that left me some feedback. A lot of people said, look, I just don't have time to sit and watch or listen to an hour of podcast, and nor do I. And so I don't actually listen to or watch any podcasts while I'm sitting in front of the computer. I do it while I'm doing other things, and I encourage you to do the same thing. So if you have any kind of iPhone, iPad, any kind of device, you can very quickly download a podcast player and search for Tim Topham, and you'll be able to subscribe, which means that all the new episodes come directly to your device. Pop in some headphones while you're driving the car, while you're cleaning the house, while you're doing some exercise or going for a walk with the dog. That's, I think, one of the best times to listen to these. So please check it out online by downloading a podcast player and searching for me there. All right, let's get straight into the interview today. It is with Neil Moore, and let's talk Simply Music. So Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's great to be here with you and spend some time with you. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, look, I know how incredibly busy you are, and so I really appreciate it. We finally found a time which suited our two schedules, yep. Which I'm really pleased about.
Yes.
So let's get straight stuck into it. I've heard a lot about Simply Music. It's obviously quite popular here in Australia, and I now know that it's pretty much all around the world. Tell us, what's it all about for those teachers who have absolutely no idea, but they might have heard about it as well?
Right. Well, you know, there's a short answer and a much longer answer, but if I were to just cut to the chase, we're an organization, a music education organization, and primarily we've been built on a piano teaching methodology, an approach to teaching piano that I developed. And this methodology is the only appropriate word that I could think of to describe it would be non-traditional. In many respects, and it's the codification of the way that music occurred for me as a very, very young child, and it was somewhat of a discovery in my adult piano teaching life that that way that music had occurred to me as a child had a tremendous relevance to current day application and to, you know, the world now where so many, many people are so interested in recreational and creative music making. Mm. So we developed a methodology, and as an organization, primarily, we train educators and licensed educators around the world who want to teach that system, that method of learning.
Yeah, look, I love any time someone says non-traditional, because you might have had a look at some of the stuff that I've got online, and my approach is 100% non-traditional, because to be honest, yeah. I just don't think the traditional is ever going to keep up. There's no doubt that a traditional classical approach to piano teaching trains students to be incredible performers of classical music, but whether they will be lovers of music, able to accompany and improvise and compose music and love music for all their lives, and whether it actually appeals to a broad market, I've always questioned. So I'm with you there.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned that you call it a method. It's more of a method than an approach. So, I mean, when we think of the traditional piano method, I'm thinking of Piano Adventures and Faber, whatever, and Hal Leonard and all those kind of stuff. So would you put it in that category?
No, look, firstly, when I'm talking about this, and when I articulate what it is about the program, I just think I've got to preface it firstly by saying I know that there are exceptions. So I'm really just talking firstly about a generalization. So if we look, for the most part, in any country in the world where music is taught formally, the all-pervasive prevailing approach is let's teach students how to read music as a means of teaching them how to play. And so there are notable exceptions to that, like Suzuki. Similar to Suzuki, the Simply Music method delays music reading in the early stages. Typically, we don't introduce reading until about some point of time in the second year. It might be earlier in the middle or later in the second year. But basically, what we want to do in the early stages, in that first year or so, is have students immediately playing music that they like to play, music that actually sounds from their very first lessons, that they've got both hands and they're playing complete songs from beginning to end, covering contemporary and classical and gospel and blues and jazz. And we also, from the very beginning, want them composing and improvising. And we have a unique way of achieving that.
It sounds also like the music learning theory approach of Dr. Gordon too, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
That, actually, I'm not, but thank you for telling me.
No. So that's I'm actually focusing on that on this month on the blog and the podcast. It's also a delayed reading approach. So it's all about audiation, listening, learning patterns.
Yes.
And I think there's definitely some crossover. So, yeah, you'll have to dig into that one.
Yeah, thanks for that. I appreciate it.
That's all right. All right, so let's tell us the story. How did it come? How did you come to develop it?
Yeah.
I think it might involve a blind student or something. I've heard some stories.
At a later stage, that actually was a critical piece of the story. And in fact, in some respects, it's a good way to get an understanding of what the program is, to know a little bit about how it came about. So I've got to go way back to cover that. So
yeah,
I'm the youngest of five kids. Born in Footscray, Melbourne, Australia, and there's only 7 years between the five of us. I have an older sister and three older brothers. All of the boys, it was a requirement when we turned seven that we begin studying piano. So by the time I was born, there were already piano lessons and daily practice happening in the home. And so I am grateful for that, because I think there's a world of difference between growing up listening to music being played, as distinct from growing up listening to music being learned, where you hear the construction of every note, of every measure, of every phrase, of every section of the song, and hear it over and over and over again. I feel that really contributed enormously to my oral development. But around about the age of three or four, as music was being played, I would hear music, and in my mind's eye, I just pictured shapes and patterns, and nothing ethereal about this. It was really more a matter of, as the melody progressed from one note to the next, I could just see a picture of that occurring. And I thought nothing of this. It wasn't something that it was even like, oh wow, what's happening? That was just the way that it occurred, and that was just natural for me. I began my lessons studying piano at the age of seven, and from the day I started, when my teacher started to play, the patterns that I could see in my mind's eye, I could see them laid out across the keyboard. And from that point onwards, the rest of my first 8 years or so of piano study was what I considered to be cheating. my teacher would play the songs I was going to be learning. I would hear them. I would see the shapes and patterns. And then during the week, I would just reconstruct the pieces entirely based on shapes and patterns. But I thought I was doing the wrong thing. And I was terrified that I was going to get found out. And as I got closer to the Saturday morning for music lessons, I dreaded it. It's like, is this the Saturday where I'm going to get caught? And so, come my lessons on Saturday, I'd sit at the piano and just blankly stare at the page, playing these pieces, all just reconstructed from shapes and patterns, just doing my best to fool the teacher. What I didn't know is he was going out to my mother and saying, Neil's not reading. He's just pretending to read and he thinks he's fooling me. But, you know, thankfully my mother said, yeah, but I mean, listen to him play. Just leave him alone. Let him do his own thing.
Yeah.
So unlike all of my older brothers who actually learned how to read, I didn't learn to read at all.
So was her approach the same with you though? Did she start you off in a middle seat position with the reading from first lesson? I assume that's how she taught your siblings.
I don't even remember the experience. I know that that happened with my older brothers. I have very little memory of my teacher, and I actually consider that to be a very, very good experience. That there was, I feel nothing that the teacher did where I felt as though I was in any way thwarted,
yep,
or in any way prevented. I was just allowed to do my thing.
Which is great.
And so,
but I know that a lot of teachers might have a student like you in their studios today and really, really worry. Oh, he's just playing by ear. He's never looking at the music. You know, how's he learning? This is all wrong. What would you say to teachers who have students like that?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, and it's a common scenario. But if we were to look at this and see it over an extended period of time, I think it's going to depend on what the intention is behind the lessons. So if we look at that traditional approach, as you were saying before, and once again, I know that there are lots of exceptions and there's a lot of teachers that have modernized their approach. But if we look at still the prevailing approach of we want to impart students with the ability to read, they need to understand the maths of music. We want them to have a good understanding of theory, foundational understanding. We want them to have a good understanding of technique. It's a very, very multiple thought process environment. And so in order to be able to impart all of that, you've really got a lot going on neurologically. And it's an enormous challenge for many teachers, more of a challenge than often teachers realize, because by and large, we haven't stopped to take the time to examine neurologically what's occurring in a multiple thought process environment as distinct from a single thought process environment.
Okay.
Right? But so if that teacher's like, I really need to work on imparting all these concepts of theory and the foundations of reading and technique, etc. But this student just wants to, you know, sit down and play these songs and play by ear. There's going to be a conflict, you know. So from our point of view, we don't experience it that so much inside the frame of our method. One, because from the very, very beginning, students are playing contemporary and classical and gospel, you know, like a really broad array of styles. If a student is progressing within the framework of the program, but outside of that they're playing by ear, I think that's a fantastic thing, and it should be allowed and encouraged. The real problem happens when you then take that student and now try to rein them in and teach them how to read, and they've got to come back to that multiple thought process. You know, unlike reading a book where you're reading one language, when you're reading sheet music, you're reading seven languages simultaneously.
What are the seven? You're talking
your pitch.
Pitches.
Yeah. You have rhythm.
Yep.
Very often there are the lyrics on the song.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Finger numbers uses a numerical approach.
Yep. Counting. There, oh, I said that, yeah.
Yeah. We have the actual form, like, you know, A, B, A, return signs, etc.
Yep.
Dynamics.
Oh, yeah.
And pedal. We've got seven distinct languages. Seven distinct languages. So it shouldn't really be called reading music. It should be called multiple simultaneous language translation. And we often wonder, why is it so hard? Well, because the brain's a pattern-seeking device, but the brain really only processes one stream of information at any one time. And so when you're dealing in a multiple thought process environment, it's like having seven lanes on the freeway, suddenly having to get through one lane of opening. And there's a backlog.
I've never thought of it like this, Neil. It's so true.
Yes, it's one of the huge problems. Yeah. One of the huge.
So before we go, I assume Simply Music has a solution to simplify the seven language style of music reading. But before we get to that, you started telling your story a little bit. We now know sort of how you started. How did that then develop into your method?
Yeah. Sorry for bouncing out.
No, you're right. It's all good.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. So I went through these years of lessons. By the time I was 12, I was playing a really diverse repertoire. Pretty much I could hear anything on the radio and sit down and build my own arrangements of songs. And, you know, I had a certain competency. I don't consider myself to be an advanced musician, but, you know, I had this competency. I stopped having lessons with that teacher at around 15. had a number of lessons, a number of attempts to learn a lot of the foundation stuff that I hadn't learned, but I didn't have good experiences with any of the teachers that I met. And so I just knew that I loved music. I knew that I belonged to music. And it wasn't really until I was in my mid-30s that I decided that I really wanted to pursue music professionally. And I didn't even know what that would look like. I just knew that I wanted to be immersed in music. And I just thought, well, look, if I'm going to do that, I need to understand the language of musicians. And so I had an opportunity to attend weekend classes at the Victorian College of the Arts. And I studied, you know, classical theory and jazz improvisation for a while there. And I also came across an alternative approach to music reading. And I did a workshop that they were doing, and I connected with that workshop. And at that time, this organization was looking to train teachers and to grow the organization. And I just so connected with that method at the time.
Do you remember who that was or what it was?
Yeah, it was Music Logic, John Barton's program.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I started teaching. Did a teacher training and immediately began teaching. And I also had an opportunity, I think, you know, because of my own relationship to music, as well as having had, a small business background, there were certain skill sets that I had that I was able to contribute to the existing teachers that were teaching that method, as well as help new teachers come on board and be trained. And I ended up, sort of elevating my position within that organization. So I was teaching and, training teachers at a very, very busy studio. I was teaching about 125 private lessons every week, about 65 hours of face-to-face teaching.
Oh, my goodness.
At that time.
One-on-one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was intense, really serious.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was really amazing.
Or madness, or both.
Yeah, it was all of that. Yeah. Amazing experience, but sort of unsustainable.
Yeah, absolutely.
In many respects.
Absolutely.
Did that for a long period of time.
Okay. And so while you're doing this, you're actually following a music logic approach. Is that
right?
That's
correct. Yeah,
but you're sort of building and developing your own skills and your own ideas.
Well, I was, and there are aspects of that were being developed into the curriculum, but it really wasn't until I had a reputation as a successful teacher. I got a call from a government agency asking me if I would be able to teach a young boy to play. This boy was blind, and they believed that they could restore his sight with particular types of surgery. And they said he's got a very rough road ahead of him. He's going to have a lot of procedures over the coming year or two. We thought it'd be really good if he could just have some sort of entertainment in his life. Do you think you could teach him to play? And I just said yes. I had no idea how I was going to do it. And it sort of didn't occur to me until after I'd committed, like, what am I going to do? Given what I knew at the time, I had no idea how I would teach a student who was blind, given that he couldn't read. And that was the only thing that I knew at the time. And it was only then that it occurred to me, just one day, I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do? And it's like, well, hang on. I never learned how to read. What was I even doing back then? I just asked myself that question. Literally, in my mid-30s, for the very first time, I thought about it consciously. And so I just sat down at the piano and started to look at how I played and bring language to it for the very first time.
Wow.
It sounds weird thinking that I'd done this for decades and had never thought about it consciously.
Yeah, right.
So I started to begin, I started to bring terms of art, explanations to what it was that I was doing. And I thought, I'll give this a shot, particularly with these shapes and patterns. I'm sure that I can put his hands in position and he can feel these shapes and patterns. And who knows, maybe it'll work. It worked. It was instantaneously successful with this kid. He'd had about 3 months of lessons with me. He had a repertoire of stuff that he was playing, maybe 12 or 15 songs, complete pieces that he was playing. I said to his dad one day, are you happy with Wade's progress? And his dad said, well, we're not only happy with it, but he's started to teach his four-year-old sister how to play this way, and she's blind.
She's blind.
It's like, seriously? I can show this kid this approach. He can have this fantastic result, and he can teach his four-year-old sister, and she's blind as well. I wonder what would happen if I started showing this to other kids. I didn't even really realize what I had in my hands then. I just thought that this would be music preschool, music kindergarten, before they got onto real music, which was doing the only thing that I knew now how to do, and that was to teach people how to read music. And so I just started showing other students this way, and I just saw results that I'd never seen before, and I thought, well, that's understandable, maybe, because this has been so natural to me for so long. I wonder if I could show other teachers and they could do this.
Mm.
That would be a completely different challenge altogether. And as I started to do that, these teachers started coming back saying, we haven't seen results like this. I mean, we're dealing with families that used to have to fight to get their kids to practice, and now they're fighting to drag them off the piano to go to school or to have their dinner or do their homework. And so that's, I thought, cool. Well, I think that I have something that's worth exploring. And so I thought, well, okay, I went into this period over years of like a laboratory setting. That's a, sort of a, not the right word, but this was R&D, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How far can I take this system before I have to introduce music reading? And does it apply across multiple genres and approaches? And fortunately, I had a really large student body and teachers that I was training that I was able to just begin road testing the concepts. And I originally launched it as a method in January of 1998,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't launch it as a distance-based teacher training program until January of 2002.
Okay. So it started as a book you could buy like any other method sort of thing.
Well, it actually just started as, if you wanted to learn about it, you had to just come and sit down with me and be trained by me.
Okay, right, got it.
In the very beginning. And people would, you know, I had teachers fly across from Australia. I was living in the United States. I had teachers in the United States who would travel, and I would just teach them what I knew and just sort of sent them away with these volumes of content.
Yeah.
It wasn't even really a structured curriculum, but it was a very vast compilation of ideas and concepts. But then I had a chance to see over the next several years, how do we need to develop and modify this as a program? And actually, before you asked about Simply Music Method, I actually relate to it as the Simply Music Program. The method is a component of the program,
right.
But the program's a little bit more broad than that, and I might have an opportunity to talk about that, you know, a bit later.
Yeah, for sure.
But so as I started to share the concept with teachers and had a far clearer idea then of how to break this down into an actual syllabus structure, and as I developed, you know, all of the lesson plans and you know, we provide a teacher training with highly detailed video of how to teach every single step of every single song for years and years of lessons. I mean, it's vast, really comprehensive. And then I launched that distance-based program in the beginning of 2002.
Right, yeah.
And we've got 700 locations in 13 countries now.
And so the 700 locations, are these people franchised, or are the teachers just trained up and then they use it in their studio? How does that work?
Yeah, it's not a franchise. You know, at the end, we looked at that extensively. I mean, at some point of time, I believe that I had something in my hands that could make a major difference to the world of music learning. And If I can, that was very important to me for a number of reasons. Primarily because as I was growing up, I always had a very playing rich experience. I was playing from the very beginning, and that's the only experience that I knew of learning music.
Mm.
But yet, when I'd speak to other kids at school, they were having piano lessons. It always confounded me about how little they could play.
Mm.
And if we were anywhere where there was a keyboard and there was no music, most of them couldn't play anything.
Yeah.
Or they'd been learning for a few years and there was just so little repertoire, and that always confounded me. And of course, as I got older, I would meet, you know, teenagers and adults and elders, all that had lessons, and they hadn't had a great experience, and that always fascinated me. And so when I saw this program, I thought, wow, not only would this apply to, you know, children across a broad array of musical genres and styles, but we started to see that, you know, that teenagers and adults and seniors were having lessons and going home and teaching their grandchildren. We had homeschool children coming and having lessons, and one of the children would go home and teach their 5 or 6 or 8 siblings how to play. And what really emerged for me is that I felt we've got an opportunity here to really create a breakthrough in complete accessibility, give everybody what I consider to be their absolutely natural, innate, foundational birthright. That is the opportunity to express their profound, natural musicianship, which every human being without exception is profoundly musical, everybody. And so, one, I had to develop the method in a way that was easily digestible and easy to assimilate, but I also needed to do it in a way that was very simple to operate. So we ended up choosing on a license system, not a franchise system.
Okay.
So teachers, you know, they register to do the training. All the training these days is online. It's beautiful. It's easy. It's simple.
And then they become licensed to use the Simply Music program. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, thing about that, Tim, one thing about that is that there are, if you're an individual teacher doing your own thing, there are a lot of benefits to doing your own thing. One of those being that you can pick and choose from any program that you like and put something together and do your own thing. And for those teachers that are doing that and who love that and that's working for them and it's working for the students and it's working for the parents, you know, I'd say fantastic, God bless you, keep doing what you're doing if you're loving it and it's working. But there's a world of teachers out there that aren't deeply satisfied, you know, that struggle sometimes, that they feel that it's hard but they perhaps don't know what else to do. And the difference with us is that given that we are an organization, we have certain quality control around the way that the method's taught and how it's taught. And so whilst people are licensed and we exercise no control whatsoever over people's business, so they can have as few or as many students as they want, work as few or as many hours as they want to, charge as little or as much as they want to, that's completely none of our business. All we want to do is just make sure that the integrity of the program's preserved. So there are certain restrictions in being a Simply Music teacher. We've just found that there's a whole population of teachers out there that believe it's worth it because of what gets offered. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, I've certainly met many people who are using it, which is why I was very interested to hear more about it. In fact, I took on, when I very first started teaching, I took on a student who had been taught your method. That was when I first ever came up with it. And the thing that I loved about it, he'd only had a few lessons, but the approach was very chordal, and my approach is very much the same. I think chords are the building blocks of music and we should be teaching them to students right from the beginning. And I love that the approach of the kind of guitar teaching approach. Teach some students some chords, which I think I wanted to get onto patterns in a moment with you. Teach some students some chords, give them some understanding of how music's constructed, and suddenly a whole world opens up to them of not only knowledge about music, but how they can actually play stuff quickly. And so I want to come back to this. You've mentioned patterns a fair bit. Many teachers might not understand what that actually means. So are you talking about chord shapes? Are you talking about scales, rhythmic patterns, or all of the above?
All of the above. So there's a couple of things that I want to address in what you said, and I agree wholeheartedly about the value of teaching chords. I also believe wholeheartedly in one of the things that's awesome about guitar is you can, you know, pick up a guitar, learn C, F, and G, and you know you've got the you know the trinity of awesome chords, you know, and off you go. So. So as a result of that, you know, we often have people saying, oh, is this a chord method? And it's not so much that it's a chord method. It's just that we have a method of teaching chords. And there's a big distinction. And so it's important to understand that from the beginning, we don't start with chords and then start to, you know, to build out the complexity of it. Our beginning students, you know, in their first 10 lessons, they've already learnt, you know, left and right hand, playing, you know, complete soloist arrangements of contemporary style pieces and gospel pieces and blues and ballads. They've also, you know, learned more sophisticated versions of those arrangements, as well as having learned the foundation of chords.
So they learn them by rote, Neil?
No, well... typically speaking, if we look at the definition of rote, it's, you know, by and large, it's mindless learning or concentrated learning from as a result of mindless repetition.
I guess I meant I might have used the wrong word. Is it taught as teacher demonstrates, student copies?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so is that not a rote kind of method? Maybe it's not.
Yeah, well, perhaps it is that, you know, I just remember in the early days when I would be asked the question and I looked up the word rote and I thought, okay, it's not that.
Times tables. It's not that.
It's not that.
But it is a teacher demonstrates. Absolutely. Student learns
in the early stages, it's learning by doing.
Yeah. And I like that. So I've started using and exploring Piano Safari. I don't know if you've heard of that method. It's a fantastic method by a couple of people in America. And it involves, as well as music reading, which is quite delayed actually, and improvising. It involves a whole lot of what they call rote pieces, which is why I use the word, where the teacher demonstrates, shows you the patterns on the piano, and you learn to play stuff quickly.
Great, love it. Yeah,
but some teachers are going to, I mean, that's going to be a freak out for some teachers who start with middle C position and there's your music reading from the beginning. Some teachers are going to see that as being, you know, a waste of time. How, you know, why don't they just learn that from YouTube sort of thing?
Yeah, well, there's a world of difference between the self-study experience. I mean, I think there's great value in learning from YouTube. And, you know, I know that there's a new breed of musician who's coming up through the ranks who are now able to sit down at an instrument and experience self-expression. And from my point of view, absolutely anything that contributes to that is a good thing. Anything that contributes to that I consider to be a good thing. Having said that, there's a world of difference between that experience as distinct from being with a teacher who understands what it is that they're doing, that has the ability to look at exactly and precisely the way that you learn and the speed of your progress and the hurdles that you in particular come up with and how to manage those and customize the experience, as well as how to take your experience and take what it is that you've learned and expand in ways that would not ordinarily come to mind for you, that foundation of knowledge. In my point of view, the partnership between a committed parent, a committed teacher, and a committed student is still by far the superior experience, even though a self-study experience can be a great experience. I just consider that the teacher-based experience is better. You asked before about what I mean by patterns.
Yes.
And this is very simple. So, firstly, an analogy. If we could imagine going out to an evening sky, a clear sky at midnight, and we're looking up at the stars in the sky, and all we just see is a sky dotted with stars. And then someone says, hey, look, do you see that brighter star? If you connect that to this one and to this one and to this one, it draws a constellation.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, out of the plethora of stars, you've been able to distinguish a particular shape. And now what will happen is people will go into the sky and they'll look around and they're able to identify that shape.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same thing is happening with music. At the piano, as it's playing from note to note to note, it's drawing pictures. These pictures are very easy to see once you know how to look for them. In fact, once you know how to look for them, you can't not see them.
And you're talking about looking at them as the black and white notes of the keyboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's almost, if you could imagine, like if we were playing from a C to, let's say, an E flat to a G.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going from the white to the black to the white. We can see that there's that triangle.
Yep.
It's amazing how often what happens in a piece, and the more complex the piece of music, very often the more prevalent the patterns are and the easier they are to see and remember and recognize. We've got to remember that neurologically, the brain, by design, is a pattern-seeking device. There is no form of instruction that it gravitates to more so than learning by patterns.
I like it.
Right.
I like it, and so, I can start seeing what... you know, what you're talking about. So rather than thinking cognitively of the C, E flat and the G, you're thinking of that kind of triangle, white, black, white. That's the shape.
Yes.
That's a pattern.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's actually a little bit like, even if you could imagine reading our language, you know, when we have a word, we don't read each of the letters in the word. We see it as a collective. Mm. We read words collectively. Yeah. So we could imagine note to note to note to note, likewise, creates a picture. Once it's seen a picture, we oftentimes have really easily identifiable patterns.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you can take these really complex pieces and distill them down into, well, let me give you a classic example. I have a way of being able to teach chords. When I mentioned to you before, we have a method of teaching chords. We can teach students to know every major triad, every minor triad, every major seventh, dominant seventh, minor seventh, augmented chord, suspended chord, diminished chord, ninth chord, 11th chord, and 13th chord in every key, just based on three shapes.
Right.
Now, I bet there's a whole world of educators there that have been sitting at, you know, their piano maybe for decades, And I could see that being like, how the heck could you possibly do that? Yeah, well, that's what happens when you get into this program. What's really extraordinary about this method, Tim, is how ordinary it is.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the simplest is the best quite often, isn't
that's
it?
That's like I've been staring at music for decades, and I haven't even seen this, and it's been right in front of me.
It's quite interesting that there's actually, I'm just thinking there's some strong similarities between your experience and mine, actually, because I had a very long break from studying as a student to actually becoming a teacher too, which meant that when I came back to it, as you did at 30, you really have to think about everything that you're doing. You don't take anything for granted, and I didn't come through a conservatory model or anything like that. And so I've taken all my experience, and I did a lot of accompanying and a lot of improvising and playing for bands and whatever else, and put that all together for the approach that I take. I think there's a lot of similarities between what happened with you at 30, and I doubt that perhaps would have happened if you'd gone straight into teaching it as an 18-year-old. It's really interesting.
I don't believe that this program would have been created if I had learned formally either. It has come at music from a different lens and from a different end of the telescope in many respects.
Yeah. I guess the other question I've just thought of is, do students of the Simply Music approach, can they end up playing the amazingly difficult repertoire of the classical era as well?
Yeah, you know, we teach not only reading. Very often, how advanced a student can get has a lot to do with the expertise and the background and the interest of the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So my view about it would be that if you came to me wanting lessons with me, and at some point of time you wanted to elevate into learning the distinctions of adult concert-level performance, I wouldn't be your teacher.
Right.
I'd be recommending you to the many people that I know whose love and passion and expertise is in that area.
Yep.
But if we're talking about learning how to play, you know, the broadly accepted, classical favorites, you know, for release of Moonlight Sonata and, you know, Beethoven's, you know, Sonata in C, mm-hmm. et cetera, that array, you know, the Bach preludes, et cetera, and the Chopin nocturnes and preludes, all of that, you know, that's just no problem. You know, the other thing too about it is that this foundation that students have, this playing-based foundation that's all based in shapes and patterns, once you have that lens, it's amazing how much simpler it is to learn how to read music, which ties us back into that problem that a lot of the teachers have had with those students that are very oral, that they have such an urge to have that experience of musical expression. When it comes back to boxing them into the maths and the formal structure, that's a tremendous difficulty that they have. And that's oftentimes, in my opinion, one of the reasons why oral players have been given a sort of a hard time. In our environment, because it's so playing based, there's a few things. When we introduce reading, we introduce it differently. It's we use an intervallic approach, which is not at all uncommon. We start by the introduction of reading rhythm. We want to, you know, human beings are profoundly musical. Every single person has to get that without exception, no exceptions, everybody, no exceptions, is deeply and naturally and profoundly musical, end of story.
Yep.
We've got to get that as a foundation. The second thing that we've got to get, I mean, oftentimes people say, what's the evidence of that? You've just got to look at talking. Talking is, you can't utter a sentence without demonstrating a mastery over extraordinarily complex musical concepts of pitch and rhythm. And yet we're just, you know, it's the guy who says, I haven't got a musical bone in my body. I haven't got a musical bone in my body. I haven't got a musical bone in my body. I haven't got a musical bone in my body. I mean, you can't say the sentence without demonstrating a mastery over, like, write that out and have a look how complex it is.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's it. Unfortunately, I have a feeling that it's a lot to do with music education that people end up saying that in their later life, and the wrong approach that people take. Hey, I want to talk about you've got a statement on your website that I found really interesting. It says breakthroughs in creativity for humanity.
Correct.
What is that about? That's not something I've seen on any method approaches or anything before.
Well, it's really the bigger picture, you know, that we're entering into a unique world. Never before in history have we been facing the profound transformational change that we're about to witness over the next decade. There is a technological tsunami that is arriving that will profoundly impact the experience of living for all of humanity. The world that we know it and as we know it now, it will look completely different in a decade. And the type of thinking, the foundational platform of education based on science, technology, engineering, and math really was that which supported us moving firstly into the industrial era and secondly moving into the technological era. But the speed of acceleration of the technological era has brought about the arrival of a completely new future. And we know that, there is a global consensus that is emerging clearly, that we need a completely new type of thinking in order to be able to deal with the future that's arriving. We know that things are changing more rapidly than ever before. They're changing more profoundly than ever before. Problems are arising that we had no prediction or idea would emerge only weeks and months ago. And we're finding that the level of spontaneity and creativity and improvisational thinking that's needed in order to deal with those problems is becoming something that we need to equip our children with a completely new access to and foundation of creativity. And we have an opportunity to do that with music more so than ever before, but not music as it has been taught, because it has been taught as a math.
Mm.
We need a different, completely different approach. We need to equip people with being immersed in the experience of their own musicianship, not only from the point of view of its educational value and its entertainment value and its expressive value, but we also need to understand that neurologically, music doesn't occupy any part of the brain. Music occupies the whole brain.
Yep.
It enlivens the brain. A child in utero that's surrounded with music, you know, in their outer world, they grow a bigger, more complexly folded and complexly connected brain.
Mm-hmm.
And my prediction is that over the forthcoming years, we're going to see an opportunity for music education to play a completely new role in what it can contribute. And so in order to do that, there are two things that we need. First of all, we need a breakthrough in methodology. We need a methodology that's accessible to pretty much everybody. If you are capable of learning, this is a program that gets anybody playing. We need a breakthrough in accessibility. As much as we need the music Olympians, as I call them, those advanced, classically trained educators that understand those distinctions of adult concert level performance, we want that and need that. But there's no better way of supporting those educators than by opening the floodgates to the masses and creating a world where everybody plays. And the absolute norm is that if you've got 100 students, every single one of them learns how to play, every mm-hmm. one of them.
Mm-hmm.
We want that to be the norm. We want that to be the norm because of what it does for a child's belief in themselves, for what it does in impacting their self-expression, their education, their entertainment, but as well as it prepares their mind for thinking in a new way. And that's the human being 2.0. That's what it is that we need to create. We need to create a completely new access to creativity. So our view is that, for me, I want a whole-of-life program. We have not yet developed a prenatal program, but I'm very, very, very interested in that, you know, from the point of view of, in the past, if a woman discovered that she was pregnant, you couldn't really say to her, hey, why don't you learn piano and start playing for your unborn child? Because it can take a year or two before you really start playing anything sort of substantial and meaningful. In our world, we want to be able to say, hey, you found out you're pregnant today. You can be playing complete songs by next week and immediately not only start nourishing your child neurologically, but begin communicating your love to your unborn child and have months and months of making that contribution to them. Extraordinary opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, we want children being born, you know, the Music Rhapsody program, the early childhood music and movement program developed by Lynn Kleiner, just a brilliant program. Another one for you, if you don't mind me mentioning it.
No,
Music
not at
Rhapsody.
All. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a program that immerses children from birth in a very rich and developmentally comprehensive music and movement experience. And so, you know, we have a program that was developed and based on Lynn's work that weaves all of the music of the Simply Music curriculum throughout that whole childhood experience. So that the idea is the child has already developed their musicianship in the womb, and developed a profound familiarity with the music, which is what happens to children. They're born into an environment now where they're able to develop their musicianship and experience through early childhood, built around music that they already have familiarity with. They reach the age of 5 or 6, and now they're able to learn how to play that music. And one of the unique qualities of this program is that as you inherit the ability to play it, you also inherit the ability to share it and teach it with others. So, you know, we see that we can do something very, very extraordinary with regards to that. And
it really is a big approach.
Yeah. And so, you know, at the same end of the scale, you know, we're working on a program at the moment, which will be a world first, to develop the first adaptive piano curriculum for children that are extremely low functioning, that have all sorts of complex learning differences. And this is a world's first. There is no program out there that's like this. And that can be taught by parents or music therapists or occupational therapists or music educators. It's really been designed so that anybody who wants to be able to bring musical self-expression to children with challenges and learning differences, they're able to do that. We're also involved in a project, the Music and Memory Project. That's another one that's worth checking out, musicandmemory.org, which is a project to bring a customized music program into 65,000 Alzheimer care facilities around the world.
Wow.
This is a miracle project. We have a technology project that we've begun to offer an incentive prize for the person who can first develop the world's first virtual piano, put on a pair of glasses and be able to see and play an instrument. We want that small enough so that we can roll that out into third world and developing nations. And so for us, it's really about how do we make contributions to large populations of people that not only offer a breakthrough in their access to music and musicianship, but also offer a breakthrough in how easy it is to learn how to share this program with others.
I love the forward-thinking nature. I love the fact that it's based on improving the lives of people around the world first and foremost. I think it's a real tribute to your own nature and approach yourself. I think it's fantastic. I can't wait to see what you guys are going to do. It sounds really, really exciting.
It is exciting, actually.
Yeah. So look, we're going to start wrapping it up. I think I could easily talk with you for at least another hour probably, but no one's going to listen to all that. So I do want to finish by asking, what does an average lesson look like? So can you just take us through, for the first, let's say, 4 to 6 months of lessons, let's say you're teaching a 10-year-old kid, they come into lessons, what does a Simply Music lesson actually look like? Can you give us a quick kind of overview of the structure of standard? I'm sure there's variety, but what does it look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's going to be a combination of things. One of the things that is important for us is to build a playlist, a repertoire of songs that the student can sit down and play anywhere at any time without the need for written music. And we want that playlist to be always maintained around 40, 50 pieces. So, you know, I mean, for a lot of students, they're, you know, preparing for exams, they're working on their current piece or two or three or four. Oftentimes, what happens is they migrate beyond those pieces that they previously learned. For us, we want to make sure that everything that's learned is retained until we've got a really full body of songs, and then the student can choose which ones they might let go as we add new things in. Mm-hmm. So one significant component of the lesson could be managing the playlist, as we call it, managing that songs are being kept alive.
Yep.
Let's have a look at your list and pick songs randomly and see that you've kept them alive. And, you know, usually if they've kept, you know, a handful of them randomly alive, they're keeping all of them alive. So that's a significant component.
Okay.
The next thing would be a focus on new material, and that would be what is the current song that we are working on. We might be introducing something or moving into the next section of that song, distilling it down into the shapes and the patterns. One of the things that's very awesome about our program is that it's really cracked the nut on being able to do group lessons or shared lessons, as we call it. Mm. We've found that the impact of learning when there are multiple people in the room at one stage, we're only really just starting to understand the power of observatory learning, you know, where the brain can look at something, see something being learned by somebody else, and the mirror neurons will begin to align and arrange themselves to be able to physically and neurologically process just that which they are observing.
Yep, there's plenty of research to back that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As well as in the shared lesson environment, students asking questions and adding points of view that the student at the instrument wouldn't think to ask necessarily. So the shared learning environment is learning with others, from others, by others, but it's all done around one instrument. It's not the laboratory setting where everyone's got their own keyboard and everyone's doing different thing, right?
Yeah.
So if it's a shared lesson, what could happen is that we're introducing new material, and we're working with the students in the early stages. It could be showing them content. It also could be playing content and saying, what do you see? What are you seeing? What are the shapes and the patterns that you're seeing? So that we're developing that generative, you know, this is really about learning a way of learning. So it's not about just all receptive, receive the instructions. You've got to teach students how to be able to see it for themselves and do it for themselves, yeah?
Yeah.
So there's a chunk of time spent on new material. Typically speaking, we might have introduced an accompaniment project where we're working in a chordal-based piece where the students are getting the experience of playing while others are singing along and or playing.
Yep.
There would be that content. We might be working, depending on where they're at in the process, it could be introducing and adding to the reading-based projects that we've been working on.
Mm-hmm.
So largely it depends on, one, how far into the curriculum they are, and secondly, our program is based on what we call the foundation program, these array of playing-based songs. And then what happens is we add a composition component, an improvisation component, an arrangement component, and an accompaniment component as they move forward into the first weeks and months. And so by the time you get several months in, you are working pretty much in every lesson on that array of components, reviewing last week's work, keeping your playlist alive, working on the new material, your composition, your improvisation, your arrangement, and your accompaniment projects. Really diverse.
Sounds,
4 or 5 projects at any time. Pretty exciting.
It sounds really, really, really good.
Cool.
I'm looking forward to finding out a little bit more about it myself, I think. So where should teachers go to find out more about Simply Music?
Well, you can find out more about the organization at simplymusic.com. You can find out more about the piano program at simplymusicpiano.com.
Great. And that's got info about the teacher training and how it all works if you want to become a teacher of Simply Music.
It does. And if this is of any value, I could also send you a link to a page that's got a series of videos that gives a video demonstration of how we teach classical pieces or blues pieces or chords or the reading approach. I'd be happy to send that.
That would be fantastic. Yeah.
To your listeners, and you can include that perhaps. Would that be okay?
Yeah, let's put it in the show notes. Yeah, that would be great. That'd be fantastic.
Okay.
I think that would really clarify it. To see a teacher in action teaching this approach, I think that would be great. Really, really good.
Okay, great.
Yeah, fantastic. Adults. Well, look, our time is up, I'm afraid. Neil, it's been awesome to speak with you.
You too, Tim.
Was there anything else that we should just very quickly finish with, or have we covered most?
Yeah, I don't know. I just talk.
As I say, I think we could talk a lot more.
Yeah, exactly.
I like also you've mentioned a couple of things today. The work that you're doing, I can't remember who it was with, but in regard to special needs students or students with learning difficulties. So I'm actually doing a focus on that later this year, one whole month on that. So I'd love to get some more information on that from you.
Yeah.
And also the early childhood.
I could definitely connect you with Karen Nissenson on that.
That would be great, yeah. And also the early childhood, you mentioned Music Rhapsody.
Yeah.
That's also going to be a theme later this year. So that would be great.
I can definitely connect you with both Karen Nissenson and Lynn Kleiner. They're both great people.
Fantastic.
And that make a great contribution to what you're doing.
Yeah, sounds great. All right, well, I think we better wrap it up there. Thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it. It was great to meet you finally.
Yeah, all the best, Tim.
Thank you very much.
We'll be in touch.
Yeah, we'll do. All right, see ya. Bye.
If the idea of a piano teacher's community where you get to access the best educational resources, rub shoulders with expert teachers from around the world, and have immediate access to feedback for any of your questions, then Inner Circle membership is for you. The Inner Circle is my private community of piano teachers from across the globe who share a commitment to creating and delivering the most inspiring, modern, and progressive learning experiences for their students. Membership is now open, so head to timtopham.com/community to find out more and get involved today. I can't wait to see you on the inside.